Okay, so today we're going to go into kind of the more practical kind of business stuff about the business side of architecture in some sense. Now, obviously, I've never practiced as an architect, so a lot of this is based on conversations with architects that I've represented or just general knowledge in the field. So I can't tell you exactly this is what's going to happen when you put together a budget or what have you. But the point of today is let's say someday you're going to hang a shingle. You've worked for a while at a firm. You've gone ahead and got your license. You took your AREs. Maybe even listened to a couple of these lectures before you took your ARE exam to remember what the questions are about on the test. But you ultimately say, I want to hang my shingle. I want to be my own architect. So how do you do that? And what are the ideas and things that you got to think about? And there's going to be many, many, many more than what's in here. And my recommendation as somebody who knows a little bit about business, a lot more about the law, is if you ever do decide to hang your own shingle and do that, hire someone that's a professional that helps you set up a business so you kind of don't go out there. You'll have already learned many things practicing in your firm. That's why you'll say, I'm ready to go spread my wings and do it myself. But make sure you hire someone that kind of helps you make that transition from just as a worker to an owner. But we're going to go into like the kind of basics here of how you charge for fees. Like, what do you think about? Like, what am I going to charge for somebody? How do I charge them? How do I do the calculations? How do I figure this stuff out? That's what today. So, there are different types of fees. And there was a question on the test that said that we talked about on Wednesday night, but you know, if you weren't there, because I know you weren't there for the one part, which is the best way to charge for a client, charge your fees. And there is no best way. So you have to look at all the different parts of it. And so we're going to talk a little bit about here, the different types of fees, so you can now understand them a little bit more, a little deeper. But every project will drive its own answer to what the fees will be and how the fees are. So the first one we have here, which there's two, the two most common are cost is a lump sum bid, and the second being the percentage of the cost of the work. So we'll talk about that first. The question here that we have here, so it's if the construction cost, that's the cost of the work, we call it here the construction cost, the contract will also call it cost of the work as a capitalized term. That you remember from looking at both at the B101 and when you see the A201, which we'll do after spring break, it's the same definition. It's the actual cost to build it, which includes material, labor. That labor may include the contractors like project manager and some people like that. But it doesn't include the price of the land, doesn't include the architect's fee, doesn't include legal fees, those types of things. So that's the cost of the work. And the architect says, I will take this project and I estimate, because the architect's giving you an estimate, it's $1 million. I will design it for a percentage of that. So what's a generally accepted percentage? That actually changes depending on what the type of the project is. So what you're going to see in the residential market can swing anywhere from 5%, maybe even 4%, depending on how big the building is, all the way up to like 15 to 18%. And what's wild about it is, as far as the fee structure, the percentage, the residential market has the largest gap between the lowest and the highest. And it has to do with a number of things. The bigger the building, the more expensive the building, you would think that you could charge a lesser fee. Because if I have $1 million building or a $10 million building, 4% of the million versus 4% of 10 million, I mean, it's a much greater magnitude, but when you're looking at what's designed between the million and the $10 million project, there's not necessarily that big a magnitude. So you would think as it gets bigger and bigger, you could have a lesser fee. The ironic part about it, though, is as you get to projects that once you kind of, right now, and I'm talking about in my knowledge I've worked on a number of 8-digit projects. I've never worked on a 9-digit house, but I've worked on a 9-digit conglomeration of residences for an individual. There are only certain architects that do that stuff. And so they are in demand, and so they charge higher. So I actually have a project right now that I'm working on that it's a $12 million. They bought the homeowner bought a four-story walk-up in downtown Manhattan. It's existing. They're not even building it. It's already an existing building. They're gutting the entire thing and rehabbing it. It'll be $12 million worth of construction on the interior just to redo it. So it's going to be beautiful and very nice. And the architect's charging 19% of the cost of construction. I had another client that this was probably one of the biggest things that I worked on. There was four structures. I think I may have mentioned it. The main house was $60 million. The guest house was $23 million or $26 million. I can't remember. The stables were $10 million, and the shed was $400,000. That architect charged, I think, 6%. Now, that was out in a huge countryside and everything else. But he wasn't kind of in that stratosphere, even though the projects were big. So they're all different things. So this, the residential market has the biggest swing. When you get into commercial office space, like interior office space, you're going to have an architect maybe charging, could be like 3 or 4%. It could be very, very small because it's highly competitive, because there's so many people that are designing interior office spaces in a downtown area like Chicago. If you have civic industrial, those things may stand, and then they get up to 8 or 10%. So you have these big swings. And as I can't tell you where they all sit right now, but as the architect, when you're out there, you're going to need to say, well, what type of project am I doing, and how am I going to set the percentage of where the market is? And we're going to do a kind of a problem as we go through in the later slides of how the costs are for that and how to bid that out. We talked about the second bullet here, the issue of the dollar curve. So that's another thing, is when you guys are doing the cost of the work and a percentage of the cost of the work, is should you get cost, should you get paid up front? So should you get it, even though you're going to say the project is going to be a $1 million project. Well, at the very beginning of that project, for the first few months that the contract and the construction is going, they may not be spending a lot of money. And in fact, your design is going to be happening before any construction is happening. So how do you communicate to the owner that I believe the estimate of this building is $1 million, and long before you even dig a hole in the ground, you got to start paying me these percentages. And hopefully, ultimately, because of the budget the owner gives and the estimates you're putting together, that your payment is properly allocated and properly spent. Because much of your billing is going to happen, especially if it's the traditional design followed by bid, followed by build, that traditional method. Your work is going to be all finished before they even start constructing, so you need to be paid before that. So that's that upfront curve you have. Other thing is, in when you talk about the client, that's why I say you got to make sure the client understands. Yes, I'm going to charge you for the percentage of the cost of the work, but we won't have incurred the cost of the work when you're writing the check. So you have to be comfortable with where that sits. The other thing that happens is, let's say you're in the middle of the project and the owner decides to increase the budget. Well, you should get more. You shouldn't be stuck to that because the cost of the work is going to go up. But the owner has to also understand that maybe something happens and they go from a three-bedroom down to a two-bedroom house. And so the house is going to be, the cost of building the house will be less. And so there'll be a reduction in your fee, and will that be taken into consideration? Sometimes an architect will put into its contract, says, I get a percentage of the cost of the work, it's $1 million. If it goes up, I continue to get more money because the cost of the work goes up. But if it goes down to an $800,000 house, I still get based on my million, because initially I'm designing for the million, and when you change the design programs, I have to do more work to scale back. So now I'm not getting paid as much, because if you're paying me off the $800,000 versus the million, but I'm doing more work to get you back down there. So a lot of times they'll say, this is my ceiling, or my basement, my floor of the original estimate of the cost of the work, even if the value of the project goes down. So those are some things you want to think about. And that's this part here, the ethical issues of overrun and underrun. You want to make sure that you are clear with your clients so they understand that. And that would be something, that would be a term you would put into the contract that says deductive change orders and the cost of the work do not reduce the fees. In fact, what you may end up getting is paid. You may have a hybrid where you have a percentage of cost of the work. And then if there are these deductive change orders, that's done on an hourly basis. And there's some things that you can think about. And that's what one thing the lawyers can tell you, that when if you bring them involved in negotiating the contracts, somebody that's an experienced construction lawyer can see those things that you may or may not. I have this point here, is what are the construction costs? Because the construction cost, as we talk about cost of the work, but the owner's going to say, well, you know, when are we calculating this? As it says, it's based on invoice of fees. When the payment is based on, like, when? Is it when they start building it? Is that how we make sure? Well, you want to do a check and balance. And so what your contract will have is a true-up provision at the end. So you say, I'm going to get 10% of the cost of the work. My estimate's $1 million. You're going to pay me as I design, and we'll get to some slides to talk about when those payments come and what the value of that 10% of the $1 million project is, $100,000, how long it takes to get you that $100,000. But when the project's finally completed, you're going to have an actual construction cost. You're going to have an actual cost of the work, and that may impact whether you get more than the $100,000 or not. And so you would have a true-up clause that says, when we get to the end of the project, if you end up the cost of the work is more than the million dollars, then I get more money then, or however that works. So there's different ways you can handle that. And do you do a change order for that? And how does all these things happen? These are different elements. Does everybody, like, who here knows what a change order is? I've talked about it a few times. So we got one. Okay, so a change order on a construction project. This is something you guys will hear this term, this language, the rest of your career. So when we have a construction project and it goes out to bid, you're going to get a price back from the general contractor. The general contractor is going to build this sheet called a schedule of values, and the schedule of values will have each discipline. So you're going to have plumbing, electrical, rough carpentry, finished carpentry, windows, doors, all the different elements of your house. And each one will have a line item of how much it's going to cost. Electrical is going to be $30,000. Plumbing is going to be $50,000. Foundations is going to be $100,000. Whatever it is. And it all total up at the bottom for that $1 million price. So that's that schedule of values. So you as an owner can see how each component of this project, each material, and that'll include material and labor in those prices, get to the $1 million. So that's your first part when a project starts. Now you start constructing the project, and you have X dollars in for excavation and foundation. The contractor says it's going to cost $50,000 to dig this hole, and then we're going to pour our forms, and we're going to put in a foundation with concrete and everything else. And this is based on what they believe the soils are. Well, it turns out when they start digging the hole that once they get down to a certain level, the soil is really mushy. It's silty soil. It's not very strong. And if they just poured the foundations like that, there would be all these problems with cracking. So the contractor comes back to you as the owner and says, hey, we have to talk to the architect to re-engineer how this foundation is going to work, or your building will crack and fall over. That is a change to the original bid. The bid had based on assumptions that they made of what the soil was. And so there's now a change in the design. So you write up a change order, and that may take the $50,000 for excavation and the other dollars, whatever is foundation, will go up. And so the contractor submits a request for a change order, and then the architect and the owner look at it and approve it, and then the value of the project goes up. So it goes from $1 million to maybe $1,050,000, or $1,100,000, whatever it is for that change. Same thing might happen is, like, I always use this example when we talk about it. You have the three-bedroom, two-bath house, and you want to add another bathroom, so it becomes a three-bedroom, three-bath house. That's a design change, not due to circumstances of the ground. That is actually the owner wants something more. So you issue what's called a change order then. Again, it's a change from the original design. So when I'm talking about here, the construction cost, that will increase the construction costs to a change order. And you should get paid that percentage of the cost of the work to that. That's how that all connects to the change orders in a project. As a general rule of thumb, well, no, I won't say even a general rule. In my 30-plus years of being a construction lawyer, I have never been involved in a project that didn't have at least one change order. Change orders happen in every single project. A good project has a change orders that value between 5 and 10% of the original project price. So if your project at $1 million, you're going to have somewhere between $50,000 to $100,000 of cost increase. That's a well-run good project. And so the owner should understand those things and budget those into their own budgets, of course, because things happen. Owners change their minds. Something may, a part may not be available. Lots of stuff that happened like that. But projects can get, for the change orders, 20, 30%, which can be very expensive, but you still have to get paid for it. You had a question in here.
So, if the change of order, should be considered in the contingencies of the contract?
So that's a good question. So there's this concept called contingency in a project. And when a contractor submits a bid, they put this pocket of money that sits over here, and they call it a contingency, and it's not applied to anything in the project, any specific line item. There's this, for the $1 million, maybe in that $1 million bid, there may be $75,000 in contingency, and it doesn't apply to plumbing, specifically to plumbing or lumber or electrical or mechanical. It doesn't apply to anything. But if something goes a little weird during the price of the project, maybe the lumber goes up just a little bit, they can draw from that contingency to still keep it within the million. A change order is going to be on top of that. The contractor is going to say, my contingency is for just kind of simple minor things, but if you changed the and added a bathroom, I couldn't have anticipated that. And so I don't want to take from my contingency, because that's just like, what happens if I bought a bunch of drywall and some of the drywall ended up and some of it was wet and damaged? Well, I can't charge the owner twice because my materials came in crappy. I'm going to go back to the drywall person, but I still got to buy new drywall. So that's where the contingency would come in. But if it's a change to the project, if we have to, because the digging of the silty soil changed because you didn't think that was the soil, or you added a bathroom, or what happened that came up that's out of the contractor's control, that's when a change order is written and the price goes up for the project. The contingency keeps it within the budget of the project. The change order makes the project more expensive.
So if the construction cost goes higher than what it was,
yes,
does the contingency cost increase accordingly, or is it stable?
So that will be depending on how the negotiation of the contract is. As an owner, I'm going to tell the contractor, you're going to give me your contingency value at the beginning and it's not going to go up. And even if the project changes, you're not going to get extra money for the contingency, because if the project changes, you're going to hard bid that. You're going to tell me exactly how much it costs to put that bathroom in. You're making guesses. You're going to say, we already know this, and I know how much a plumbing fixture is, and how much a toilet is, and how much this, and this, and this. So your number for that change is going to be the exact number. And you're going to show me invoices and everything else. That's as the owner. The contractor may end up building a little bit of fluff in there anyway. They may pad the bid a little bit so they don't identify it as a contingency, but they have some flexibility. And there's all different ways that you can do, that you can get additional money to the contractors, and I won't go into all that. There's these savings clauses, there's line item shifts of where you can do it. There's lots of ways that you can use money in a project budget, even in conjunction with the owner, that you talk about this. And I negotiate a lot of these types of savings clauses with contractors between owners, because, again, the goal is to get from beginning of the project to the end where everybody's happy. And if the owner knows that the money's moving around but he's getting a better product or a good product, sometimes they're okay with paying that additional money. And so that's where the contingency sometimes can be used, and sometimes there's a big fight over contingency. Like, there's a lot of negotiation. I will say this, on most of my construction contract projects, when I've been negotiating construction contracts, one of the last things that's negotiated is the contingency paragraphs. Because we already know what the number is, and the contractor wants more of that, and gets wants more freedom with that, and the owner wants less freedom, and so we negotiate a lot of different stuff. So that's a big item that comes in for the dollars that is negotiated at the very end. So, but contingency is a different beast than a change order. A change order is additional work and additional costs. And when we're talking about here, on the slide up here, this is talking about what the architect's fees are. And so if that change order happens and the project becomes more expensive, the architect, because it's based on the cost of the work, the architect's fee will also go up. So the owner has to recognize not only the cost of the work of the project going from $1 million to $1,100,000, but the architect's fees was $100,000, now it's going to go $110,000. The owner has to recognize that both are going to go up when the actual cost of the project or the construction cost goes up as well. Okay? Question back there.
Clarifying question about the increase of trees have to do with, it's now like, you know, because the budget is bigger, that percentage, the dollar amount that percentage represents gets bigger, or is it like the percentage gets negotiated larger because the project is kind of getting bigger?
So in 95 to 98%, it's the former. It's the fee doesn't change, the percentage doesn't change. Sorry, the fee does change. The percentage of the cost of the work does not change. It stays at the 10% or the 8%, whatever's negotiated in the contract. And the value of the project goes up, so that means as a result the fee, the actual fee paid goes up. That's in like 95 to 98%. I have had a few projects where as a result of two things, that percentage will change. The simplest one is the project gets started, the designers are working, an economic issue comes up, and so the owner puts everybody down and says, pencils down, we're not moving on this project. And then a significant period of time, and I have a project like that right now, that the project was mothballed for about 2.5 years, and now the architect's percentage has gone up because the economy's changed, because life has changed, because everything else. And they said, so what we were charging you in 2022 is not what we're going to charge you in 2025. So it was about 2.5 years, and so the percentage went up by that. And that's an economic driver market, and that's actually probably the most reasonable market. The other one, which is the rarest, but it does happen, is the complexity of the project, which could be for all different manners. The complexity of the project may be that you're bringing in some high-tech technology, and that was something that may not have been initially thought about in the beginning, and so the architect is taking on more responsibility, and as the project itself kind of morphs and grows, and those would be more like a fast-track project where design and construction is all kind of happening at the same time. The architect may come back and say, you're asking for me to do something that's bigger in scope and scale, so my percentage fee, because my risk is higher, may have to come up. Or it may be factors that are just like the responsibilities you're asking me to take on. Like, I've had projects where in the beginning there was an owner and an owner's rep, and a lot of things were happening, and so the architect didn't think they were taking on many of the traditional payment responsibilities. But as the project continued, the architect realized, hey, I'm doing a lot more than I thought. When I built my budget, my understanding of the project was this, and I think I should get more of a percentage, a higher percentage. That's a harder negotiation for the architect to be successful in, because we're like, hey, this is your job. You should know your job. But it does happen. It's very rare. I recently had one of those where the architect got a significant bump in fee, and there was lots of discussion with myself and the owner and the owner's rep of why this happened. The architect didn't get nearly as much as he wanted, but he did get a bump in fee because his job responsibilities were significantly greater than the initial discussions. So, is that like a fire alarm? Are we concerned about that beeping? Oh, it's the sound from like my atmosphere lamp. Okay. All right, good. Okay. Any more questions on this about the construction cost and the percentage of the fee? Okay, second one. This is the simplest one. The fee that you're going to charge is based on a lump sum. I will design that $1 million building for $100,000. It doesn't matter whether your building is going to be $1.2 million or $800,000. You're still going to pay me just a flat lump sum of $100,000. That's a project that you want to make sure when you're using this market is this methodology, not market, but this methodology, is you understand your market. You understand how much time it's really going to cost you or take you to do this. So what you don't want to find yourself is like, oh, I'm going to do this for 6% because it looks like a good number, and then it realizes it's cost you, takes you, it should have been 8% because of the dollars spent, and we're going to do a calculation of how that could burn you. So you have to know the people that are on the team. You have to know, before you start doing bidding, and my recommendation, if you're going to hang your own shingle, before you start putting out lump sum pricing, you should have done this project a number of times, whether it's at a percentage of the cost of the work, which is always the safest, or an hourly. A lot of people don't like hourly, which is the next one we're going to talk about, because it could be really expensive, but at least you have a basis to say, for this three-bedroom, two-bath house, I'm going to spend this many design hours on the project. And then I can charge that, and when I've seen it over and over and over and over, then I can get a basis of saying, okay, this is how much it's going to cost me, how do I make a profit on that, and I can do a lump sum. So, you have to look at your previous analysis. You got to assess your overhead, your profit margins. You know, do I have a team that's going to have a brand new baby architect on it, and that architect maybe will have cost you more money because they've never done it before? Is the team really sophisticated? They can do it faster, and maybe you can make more profit. So there's all those things you balance in when you start trying to figure out pricing on a lump sum. The owners like it because that's just it. They don't have to start looking at how many hours you spent. They don't have to do the calculations of whether the project was more expensive or not. So the lump sum fee is very attractive to the owner, and it can be very profitable to the architect, because if you become very efficient in how you do this, you can build in quite a bit of profit into that lump sum, and if the owner's happy with paying the lump sum, and you can be very profitable. So it can be good for both sides, but you want to be... You should need to take some time before you start diving into this thing. A couple questions that happen. How do you bill the for increased fee when the construction cost goes up? What if the scope changes? What if it goes from that two-bedroom or three-bedroom two-bath house to a three-bedroom three-bath house? When you get that change order and the scope changes, how do you bill for that? Because you said to the client, well, it's an $800,000 project or a $1.2 million project. We're working off $1 million, and I want $100,000. Well, you need to build into your contract that says if there is a change order where the owner asks us to do additional design work, and those are the additional services that we talked about under Article 4 of the B-101, if those additional services are being requested, and there's a whole list of them, if you remember, there's like a dozen of them, I get to charge you for that. And you can either charge those as lump sum fees, or you can charge those as hourly. You would not normally charge those additional services on a percentage of the cost of the work. So you can come in and say, I got a lump sum of $100,000 to design your $1 million house, and any additional services I'm going to bill you hourly, and then you're going to have an attachment to that contract that says, here's all of my hourly rates. You know, the principal gets this, the senior associate gets that, associates and so forth and so on. So they will have an understanding when the owner asks you to do more, you will be charging more than likely than not by an hourly rate. The question here, additive change orders or deductive change orders, the additive change orders fall into this with the construction cost goes up or the scope changes, they fall into that pattern of the additive because it's something that's been added to the project. But the deductive change orders, as I said, when the client comes back to you and originally it was a three-bedroom, three-bath house and they say we want to remove a bath, you're going to have to do additional design work. And so you have to make sure that the owner understands that you should be paid to fix the design, even though the cost of the project is going down because you're removing the whole bathroom, you still should be paid for those services because that was a scope change. And so the deductive change order applies to the cost of the work that the contractor's charging, but you actually may get more money because you have to design removing something. And there's coordination for that, and there's changing where electrical goes and plumbing and all that other stuff when you remove a piece from the project. So that's something you have to make sure it's understood with the contractor or the owner about that. What happens if there's inflation? What happens if the market prices influences? Well, go ahead, you had a question first. So the question is, for everybody who wasn't here, the owner have the right to ask the architect of how we broke down our pricing to get to this sum? And are you asking about the lump sum?
Yes.
Yes. So you have the right to do anything in a contract negotiation. So the answer to your question on a very simple level is you can tell them, I'm not going to tell you how I broke out my fee. As a business recommendation, I would never say that to an owner. What I would say to the owner is say, I can give you a high-level breakdown, but some of the back behind-the-scenes stuff is my own my own way I run my business, and there's certain business things that I don't want public or what have you, but I can give you a general breakdown, and we're going to have a couple slides that will show you how you can do that. And then you're going to have to probably, because you're going to have profit built into all of your stuff, You don't necessarily have to show them the detail of how that profit came if it's going to be on a lump sum. If it's hourly, they're going to see every single hour billed, and so they'll know that exact. But if it's a lump sum, you can give them some breakdown, but you don't necessarily have to go into the very, very minutia so the owner sees what profit you're making. The reality is the owner recognizes that we're all in a business to try to make a profit. So it would be ridiculous for them to believe that you weren't building some profit in. But what you're doing, and I'll show you that slide in a little bit, is so the owner is the best reason why you do this is so the owner can figure out what money they need when. It's called a burn rate. So if I'm an owner and I'm building a project and I'm going to have to pay $100,000 to my architect over X period of time and $1 million to my contractor over Y period of time, I need to make sure I have the cash available from starting the project to the end of the project. So I need to make sure that I'm understanding when I'm spending the most and the least. And so that's why the architect will give some of this information. They're going to say, well, this part of the project you're going to be paying me a little, this part of the project you're going to be paying me a lot. So the owner knows when they have to have the cash available for those payments. So the two parts here is we were going to talk about the inflation and price, market prices influences. If you have a lump sum, you still are stuck to that because it's not based on the cost of the work. So the project may go from $1 million to $1.2 million because of inflation, because the cost of materials are more expensive, or market will cause the materials to be more expensive, whatever it might be. You're still only going to get the $100,000 just because there's outside factors going in. Where your fee will go up from that $100,000 off of that lump sum is when you have to do additional work, but not from these other outside factors. You're stuck with that lump sum fee. And that's why you want to build in your profit, and that's why, like, if the project takes a certain period of time, there's a provision in the B101 that says after so many months that this project is ongoing, I can come back and renegotiate. There's actually a paragraph in there, I think in the latter part of Article 11. So it gives you the right that after 12 months, after 18 months or whatever, I'm allowed to come back and renegotiate because my prices have gone up and you have made the project run slow or something. So any more questions? Any questions also on fees for lump sum? Last one here is hourly basis. This is simple. I mean, it's got three little parts. There's no limit to how much you can charge. Every single hour, and the reality is you guys will break down, I think in the architecture business, you guys break it down by quarter hours. My world, I break it down by every 10 minutes. The work, I bill all my stuff hourly. And all my work is literally every 6 minutes, every tenth of an hour. Every 6 minutes of my life, I have to record. Now, sometimes on a phone conversation, like if I'm on a phone call for 8 minutes, do I bill them for 1/10 of an hour or 2/10 of an hour? Like, you have to do stuff like that. But you guys, normally architects, I think, is a quarter of an hour, sometimes even a half hour. But you would write down, I was working on this project. Now, a lot of times, you'll be just working on the design for the whole day, for the one project for the whole day, and you just write 8 hours, you know, my house. And so it's very basic and everything else. But it doesn't matter what the price of the project is, it doesn't matter how much the owner is spending on construction, it doesn't matter what the market rates are, it doesn't matter any changes or all this other stuff, every single minute you are working on this project, you are getting paid for. And that's where the no limits are. And that's where owners get a little bit nervous because they say, okay, I'm building a $1 million house, I talked to 3 other architects and they said they would do it for a 10% cost of the work, or some person said I'd do a lump sum for $100,000, so both these architects so they can design my house for roughly $100,000. You're telling me you want to do it on an hourly fee. What happens if it goes over $100,000? And you as the architect says, will you pay me? What if it goes over $150,000 of the hours you're working on? Will you pay me? What if it goes to $200,000 of the hours working on? Will you pay me because it's an hourly rate? And so the owners can get a little bit nervous on that. But on the flip side, which I think I mentioned on Wednesday night, there are some projects, like if you're asked to come in and do the design work on a renovation, that's why one of the projects that I recently worked on got an increase, you don't know what's behind the walls. And so there may be a whole bunch more design. And so there's some projects that it's better to bid hourly because of the unknowns. And you tell the owner, I can't tell you how much it's going to cost to redesign this space because you're asking me to gut rehab, and when we find out what's behind these walls, I mean, it could be that there are walls that are deteriorating and now I have to design a whole new structural system, or that the plumbing is so bad we have to rip all that out and I have to redesign the whole plumbing system. And so the only way to be fair to me is to do it hourly. So again, there's different ways to make sure your client understands that the hourly is the best or the only way for that. Second point up there, this method can reward inefficiency. If you have a team that's just not good or they're inexperienced, they're going to spend more time on it because they just haven't done it. And that makes you more money as the architect because there's more hours spent on it, but it's not necessarily efficient. And so the owner could get upset saying, it takes you so much time, you're behind schedule, and I'm paying you to be behind schedule. This doesn't make sense. And so there's some balances where you got to have the right team to make sure you're delivering the most efficient product for the client as well. And then this last part of fixed rate versus current rates. Sometimes you may be designing on a large project and the design's going to happen over a period of 2 years. Well, most architectural firms, at the beginning of the year, their rates increase by a certain small percentage, just by cost of living. And so when you negotiate that hourly contract, are the rates fixed? So I signed the contract in 2025, and when it becomes 2026, I'm still on the hourly rates of 2025, and when it becomes 2027, I'm still on the hourly rates of 2025. Or, when I sign that contract, do I put in language that says, at the beginning of each year, our rates are going to go up? And they're both things happen. I've worked on both types of projects, where it's either fixed, and the whole life of the project, the fee doesn't change, or where the fee changes on an annual basis. So those are all part of the negotiations. Depends on your negotiating power on the architect side. The large corporations that I work with almost always get fixed fees because you want to go work for them. One of my clients is Microsoft, and they like fixed fees and people that want to work for Microsoft because they're a big company, and it helps the architects get their props. They will negotiate fixed fees. So, question? So your question is an architect starts working on the project and they want to pad their time because they think they can make a little bit more profit, or maybe they're just not good at what they do. What are the owner's rights on that? And you could bring a breach of contract action because, remember, you're performing to the standard of care. So if you find that there's these gross, potentially, misstatements, if you think that the work after some... like a lot of people get a gut feeling and they're looking at it and say, you know, I'm spending too much money here, this doesn't make sense, or it's taking too long. I would, at the first part, I would go back and I would have meetings with them and sit them down and say, your team isn't doing what they need to do, and we're gonna move on or whatever. So maybe it doesn't have to be super threatening in the beginning, but as you move along, you as the owner will want to do your best to keep checks and balances on that. That may be including you bringing in hiring your own owner's representative to watch both the architect and the contractor, because they should have a basis of understanding of how much time something should be and whether these bills are fair and reasonable within the market. The architect themselves, and where you go to a potential breach of contract, their standard of care is to act as an ordinary architect with similar circumstances in a similar project in a similar locale. That just doesn't mean that the design itself is like that. That includes how they operate their business. And so if the architect starts overcharging or padding the bills or doing things like that, they're outside of the standard of care. And you can say, look, I talked to these two other architects and lump sum was $100,000 and cost of the work was 10% of $1 million. Both of these are $100,000. And I see you on a trajectory that's going to cost me $150,000, and we haven't changed anything. Are you really being fair and reasonable here? So you can use those tools as leverages to try to keep your architect's feet to the fire. So that's your protection of the owner.
So are you
Yes, so it will take time. It's not going to come out right away. You're not going to see that right away.
So then, should people after they get their home break up,
so what would happen, let's say it's very egregious, and let's say you're able to prove that the architect has padded their time or is not efficient. What would happen is there would be work that would have been performed by the architect up to the date in which there would be probably a termination of the contract. And then if you remember in, I think it was Article 9.7 of B-101, where it talks about The owner has to pay the architect for the services performed through X, and the architect then gets their drawings back. But if there has been a breach by the architect, the owner keeps the rights, the license, to these drawings to finish the project. So the owner can retain that. So if I'm able to show that you as the architect are in breach, I get to keep your drawings and I get to hand it to the next architect. And the next architect, I have to negotiate with them because they're going to say, yeah, I'm going to use these drawings, but I'm not going to be responsible for any screw-ups that have been done thus far, because there may be bad architecture in there, and you're going to pay me to finish the project out. And whatever I end up ultimately paying to finish the project out, which is always going to cost more money because they have to get up to speed and they know they have you in the bind, so they're going to charge you a higher percentage or whatever it is, then what you do is you still have brought this breach of contract action against the first architect, and you end up going for your damages like we did in the calculation. You have to pay, you thought you were going to pay $100,000. You find out that first architect is overcharging you, but it still costs you $150,000. Well, you should be able to get $50,000 extra from this first architect, and depending on since you got the drawings, you got the benefit of what you've paid, but you should only still have to pay that $100,000 because that's what you thought from the fair and reasonable. So yes, you can get compensated from the original architect, and there'll be fights over that, but that's how that would work out. So, okay? Any last questions on hourly rate? All right, this is the slide that I was talking to you when you asked the question about can and should we give some type of breakdown of how much those monies are. So this is something that you can use in all different types of fees as far as the percentage and everything else, is these phases here. So let's say you had a lump sum bid for $100,000. Well, the owner's going to say, can you break that down? And you're going to say, well, of the $100,000, $15,000 goes in schematic design, $20,000 is for design development, $40,000 is construction document phase, $5,000 is the bidding negotiation, and $20,000 relates to the construction administration while the project's being built. These are your generally traditional numbers you're going to see for a project breakdown by percentages. This bidding and negotiation, sometimes this will go away. The architect says, I don't want to be part of this. And they'll flip that 5 and it'll go into the CD, so the 40 will go to 45. Depending on some of this way the project is, some of these can be skewed a little bit more, a little bit less. Some projects that are probably more simple and basic, they may have much less time in SD and more in DD. There's different ways that you can do this, but you're going to start to see. But this is, if you Googled the five phases of architecture and the percentages, you're going to come up with this almost exact, and any time you can go the breakdown. And there actually are, interestingly enough, there are sites that will be able to tell you not only the percentages, but there are sites that talk about what the average percentage of the cost of the work you're going to bid in a regional geographical area. So I can't remember I was looking at this last summer. There was it's a website, and it talks about the breakdown of project costs for an architect's fees, and it'll ask you like what geographical location of the country is. So you put in a city, and you put the type of project in, and then it'll break this chart down like this. It'll do something to the specs. Pretty cool. So, now this, what we're going to do here, so this is the math we're talking about here. So this is a project where your fee is $600,000. So instead of $100,000, you're going to get $600,000 from the owner for your architectural design fees. Now, part of those design fees is you're going to have to hire the electrical engineer, the mechanical engineer, and the structural engineer. Remember, those are three basic services, if you remember in the B101, that says you're going to do architecture, but your other basic services include electrical, mechanical, and structural. The mechanical is heating and plumbing. So what you traditionally kind of think about, and these are all very 30 to 50,000 foot percentage breakdowns here, is roughly about a third of your total fee will go to those three consultants. So we have the 600,000, so it's about 200,000 you're going to be paying to those three types of engineers. So your architectural fee, you as what your firm is going to generate, because this $200,000, you have to pay these subs. You have to pay the sub consultants. So you want to get $400,000 for your architectural services. And how does that break down? Well, if you add these fees up, take your percentages, and so like this is a project that's roughly a two-year project. So you have, or maybe eight, nine, just under 2 years. So this is about, this looks like it's like 21 months. So if it's a 21-month project here, you're going to figure, I'm going to spend about 2 months doing schematic design. And then we're going to spend too much a little bit divine development. You know, maybe these things flip. Maybe this is 6 weeks and this is 9 weeks, you know, but somewhere around that. 4 months in CDs and a month on bidding negotiation, and the project to be constructed takes a year. So this is how many months you're going to be working for the owner on this project. And your total fee you're going to bring in for just the architectural work is $400,000. So are we following all this right now? So you got to break that $400,000 into dollars here. So if you add these all up to 60, 81, 60, 20, this will add up to $400,000. So you're going to be budgeting how your project works. You're going to say, I need to make sure that I keep my costs, my internal costs for those first 2 months, $60,000 or less. So what you're looking at is I got to pay for my the electrical of the place, the rent of the place, you know, postage stamps. Oh, and by the way, the architects that are designing, and how many do you have on there? How many architects are working? And that comes in with this $60,000. It's all put into this budget over 2 months. And you tell the owner, you got to pay me monthly, so you're going to be paying me $30,000 each month. So the owner gets an understanding of what, as I call the burn rate. Remember I talked about the owner needs to know when their money needs to be available. So you say to the owner, hey, for the first 2 months, you've got to make sure you're going to be paying me $30,000 a month. The next 2 months, because design development is a little bit more intense, there's a little bit more, maybe add a half, another designer onto it. Maybe the schematic is a designer and a half. Maybe for DD, you have two designers. So that's why it goes up in percentage and a little bit more cost. So you tell the owner here that you're going to have 2 months of paying me at a roughly $40,000 a month for those fees. But then when we get to construction document phase for 4 months, well, now you've got to have a lot of people there that are designing. They're going to be drawing it out. It just takes more time because they're very detailed and the time and the intensity. And so that's going to be more expensive here. So you're looking at $160,000. And so you tell the client, you're going to have four times over the 4 months, you're going to be spending, each month another $40,000 per month. And it goes through to the end. So that's the way you can break this down to your original question is, can I give a breakdown to the owner of how I got to this $400,000 fee? And the answer is, this is what you would probably show them, this chart here. It doesn't show where your profits are. It doesn't show how you broke down each design hour or each person working on it. It doesn't give that big, like the very macro level of it, or the micro level. I'm sorry, micro, not macro. It's a very high level. But it gives the owner what the owner wants to see. Most importantly, the owner wants to see this. They want to see this far right column on payment. But this can help the owner understand why those costs are, because they're seeing, hey, because I look at my B101 as an owner and I got a SD phase, a DD phase, C phase. So the owner sees those phases in the contract and recognizes that your breakdown in dollars for that $400,000 is going to be as we see on the board here. Now, as I said, this could be based on hourly, lump sum, or cost of the work, because what's going to happen is when you're doing your project analysis, let's say you're going to do a lump sum for the project, well, you're going to know all these numbers in advance because you've designed this type of building a bunch of times. And so you're going to say, hey, I know if I do this type of design, if I charge the owner $400,000 for my fees, I'm going to make X number of profit so I can give him this spreadsheet. If I'm going to do it as a percentage of the cost of the work and I want $400,000 and it's a 10% of the cost of the work, this is a $60 million project. That's the $600,000. We subtract the $200,000 and now we have the $400,000 cost. I'm sorry, $6 million, not 60. $6 million. Do my math better. So there's a $6 million project. And so my $400,000 will be based on $4 million of architectural services, and I can still give them the same spreadsheet. So the owner can still see the same spreadsheet. So as long as you as the architect, whether you're using lump sum, hourly, or percentage of the cost of the work, as long as you behind the scenes as an architect calculate where your final number is that you want to get, which is this $400,000 number, doesn't matter the methodology of the fee structure, you can still give the owner this, because this will give the owner an idea of scheduling of how long things are going to be taking and the idea of the owner of what they're going to be paying each month. Okay? Does that make sense? All right, so now we're going to take that concept and we're going to talk about how do you manage the money in your firm. So, As I said, there will not be math problems on this, but this is a math exercise, and I may screw it up because it's been a while since, it's been a year since I did it. But the rates in here that I have up here are based on, like, small-town America, middle-town America. Like, this is not Chicago rates. You know, because a principal in Chicago is not going to be making $175,000. At a big firm, principals will be making significantly more. So this is middle town America. You know, I went in, what I did when I built this is this website that I was talking to you guys about. I went in, I punched in, I don't remember what town it was, but then we kind of pulled these numbers out of it. So here's you as an office. You're going to start this office, and how much cost, and what do you need to do to be able to be profitable as a business? That's what this is showing you. This is what sometimes you can call a pro forma. This has very, very high level. There's lots and lots of more stuff that's going to go on your final accounting spreadsheet that's not put in here, or to be broken down in more detail. But for purposes of this discussion, we're just going to kind of go with this at about, like I said, about 30,000 foot. So you got a small office, and the number of people that work in your office, you have 8 people that work in your office on the design side, okay? These are revenue generators. You're also going to have, as we talk about over here, a secretary, receptionist, you're going to have people that are non-revenue generators, but you're going to need to have them, and they're going to be a cost to the operation of the business. So revenue generators, they'll have to get paid. So this is what we're looking at are your costs. These are your costs to run your business. So we have a principal that makes $175,000 a year. We have 2 associates that make $75,000 a year. We have a senior architect, which is below the associate, the way the structure is, at $65,000. We have a couple junior architects at $55,000, and a couple beginner draftspersons or what have you that are making $35,000 a year. So this is your payroll of revenue generators here that's going to have a cost of about $570,000 of your payroll of cost revenue generators for on an annual basis. Now, we have like a $45,000 percentage built into here because things may happen, there may be changes you could build in. You could say the breakdown of some of these costs over here will go in because maybe 2 of these guys get a car, or maybe there's other perks or whatever. So this is still money that's going to go in addition to their salary. Maybe bonuses. There's a bunch of stuff that could factor into here. And then everybody gets health insurance. And in this number, this $100,000 of your health insurance premium, it's just a plug number. I have absolutely no idea how much health insurance premiums are. But you as a business will be paying for the 8 people plus your secretary and receptionist for your 10 people at your office will be paying health insurance for them. The $100,000 probably is woefully low, but it's a plug number that I have just for this analysis here. So you have a payroll cost of everybody working at the firm here on the revenue generating side of $715,000. You have to make sure that you make at least $715,000 a year to cover just the payroll of that side of the equation. So we look on the miscellaneous expenses. These are expenses versus costs, which is a little different, but so you have to, and it's just word that goes on the spreadsheet, but they're all going to be ultimately costs to the business. For the secretary that's handling, maybe there's 2 secretaries, maybe there's 1, they're handling everybody's, you know, typing their letters, whatever needs to go out, handling those types of things. You have a receptionist, your rent, you got to rent the space where you're working unless you own your building. Your professional liability insurance, so this is the insurance that if something goes wrong, these are your premiums on an annual basis that you pay your insurance carrier. Other insurance, so that would be auto insurance, commercial general liability, workers' comp, those types of things. So you're spending $105,000 in insurance. This is to protect you versus the insurance over here. This is the health insurance as a benefit on the left-hand side to your workers, whereas this is the insurance in case you get sued. All right? Printing costs, you're going to be printing out papers and drawings and documents, phone and fax, utility supplies, legal, you got to have, every once in a while, you're going to call me up and say, hey, Hanahan, help me on this contract. So that's an expense to your firm. Your accountant, you want to make sure that your taxes are done every year properly. And then a miscellaneous cost, you know, whether that's, you know, donuts every Friday or you know, whatever you offer, the coffee, people get Starbucks at the office. You know, like, I don't remember if it was one of you guys, but somebody was telling me that their boyfriend works at a, or maybe husband, I'm not sure which, but works at a company where they give them no coffee at all. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, they had to bring their own coffee, and it was a huge company. So at least we have some coffee built into this miscellaneous here for you. So now we have another, on a very, like I said, 30,000-foot level for your 10 people in your office, another $380,000 of money that you have to cover every year. So we start to look at that, and we say, how do we calculate then how we make money? So if we take on the left side over here, you're going to be billing. You're going to be hoping that your revenue generator is going to be billing 40 hours a week for 50 weeks because everybody gets their 2 weeks vacation. So you want your revenue generators to be generating, each one of these eight people up here, $2,000 of revenue generated business. I want every year 2,000 hours of revenue generation. So it's roughly like $177 hours a month or something like that. There's a breakout of that. So now here's the thing that a lot of people don't understand in the billable hour world. To bill 8 hours, you normally have to work 10 hours. Because you're going to be gone for an hour at lunch. You're going to be chit-chatting with your friends and everything else. You got to come in, you take your coat off, you got to get ready to leave. So you're at the office for 10 hours, and out of that 10 hours of physically being at the office, or now we work at home, but out of those hours that you're physically there, you're only going to be able to generate roughly 8 hours of time for that. So you got eight people generating revenue at 2,000 hours a year. That's 16,000 hours of revenue generation. That's your goal. That's your goal to say at the end of the year, when I look at my books, I've been able to generate and bill to my clients for these 10 people, these 8 people, $16,000 or 16,000 hours of services where I actually worked on a timesheet, worked on Bob's house, and I sent that bill to the client. So if we take the $715,000, because you use your revenue generators, $715,000 here, you divide it by your 16,000 revenue hours. That means if you were billing, on an average basis of each one of these, if you were billing your client $44.69 an hour, you would break even. Now, that's really cheap. Like, an architect only billing less than $50 an hour, that's really cheap. So, like, oh, this is easy. I can get $50 an hour. I mean, I would be the cheapest architect in the city. Well, then you forgot there's on this other side here, there's another $380,000. So you take your $380,000 and you divide it by the $16,000 and you get your $2,375. So now you add those up together, now you're up to about $70 an hour. So you have your $44.69 plus $2,365 gets you $68.44 an hour. So just to break even based on this high level thing, you have to charge on an average basis roughly $70 an hour per billable hour. Is that making sense? There is no profit built into this. There's no wiggle room. There's no anything built into that $7 an hour. So this is just being able to keep your doors open and the lights on, and nobody's really happy because nobody gets a bonus and nobody gets a break and they're working 40 hours a week and they're killing themselves and everything else. But that's your base number, is $68.44 an hour that you bill. You, of course, would never bill that to the client because you have to build in all the wiggle room and there's going to be inefficiencies and everything else. But just for you to see the basis. So if we go to the next slide, we're going to start, okay, how do we make a profit? We start with that $68.44 an hour. And you want to say, let's say we want to make a 20% profit on every piece of work we do. Now, a lot of firms are going to be a much higher profit, but just again, for this as a basis for the analysis here, I say I want to make my firm to be 20% profitable. So that you take the 68.44 times 20%, you get add another $13.69. So you add these two together, you get $82.13, and the final is that we round up to make it even. So your average billing hour rate, and it's average over 8 people, comes out to be $85 an hour. You're going to have those junior architects that are going to be billing at like 40 or 30 or whatever, and the senior is going to be billing at 160 or whatever it is, whatever those numbers are, to balance to get to your $85 an hour. And you may end up having, because it's the senior principal, that guy or woman who's running the firm, they're not going to be billing 2,000 hours. They're even billing 1,000 hours because the other 1,000 hours they're working is meeting with clients, is taking people to dinner, is running the business. There's all this time. The higher you go up in a business, the less revenue you generate because you have to run the business. And so that ends up happening, so it skews, and so while you can get more money per hour as a senior principal, your lower people have to work much more harder, and so that's how you got to figure out how your balance is. But for this company, this small-town America architectural firm of 10 people, to make a profit, it's got to average out for all 8 revenue generators of $85 an hour. Okay? Does that make sense? All right, let's go to the next level. You can charge lump sum, yes. So what you want to do, so that's a great question. And there was, when you started asking that, I forgot one other factor you want to build into this concept of how much you're billing per hour. So if you look at a project, if you remember the chart we had that showed how much time was going to be spent per month, okay? And if you think that we're in schematic design, and that's 15% of the project, and it's for 2 months, and it's $60,000 for those 2 months, what you're going to do is you're going to say, how many hours of my people are going to be working during those 2 months, actual revenue-generating hours where on the boards and they're designing and coming up with schematic design, how many hours are they going to actually be working during that period of time? And how much does it cost for those hours? And my knowledge after doing this analysis is that it's $85 an hour. So if they spend 100 hours, that's $8,500. So it's actually, you can do your lump sum bids based on knowing how many hours are going to take as long as it fits in, because I think we have 30 and 30 each month. So as long as you stay under the $30,000 for that schematic design phase level of each month, and you have your two designers working $8,500 a month, so that's $17,000, and you're billing $30,000. Well, you're making an almost double profit. So, and that means those numbers are just made up. But yes, you can bid lump sum because you know how many hours you're going to spend. Now, one thing that you want to think about too. This is one thing I did forget about when we talked about this $85 an hour thing. It is not factored into this, but the concept is factored into this is that you collect 100 cents on every dollar you bill. It's called a realization rate. I can tell you that, no firm ever operates at 100% realization rate. A good profitable firm will operate between 90 and 95% realization rate, but there are sometimes when you make a deal with a client where you're like, I'm going to bill you less because you may give me volume business. And so the realization on that client is only 70% of the 100. This is if you collect every single dollar. So I probably could have another slide and not going into it that could say, well, we round up to 85, but we have a realization rate of only 80%, so now we got to get more money to make that in, so now your 85 goes to $100 an hour, whatever it is. So those are all math things. That's why I say hire a professional, because I don't really know, but realization rate is of how much you can collect is part of doing business. Question? Okay, let me see if I can make it different. Let me try to put it in real-world context. I tell a client that I'm going to do a project for them for $100,000. And I bill them $100,000. And I like the client, I like the project, but there's been some snafus here and there because it's life and it's reality. And projects, sometimes everything doesn't go smooth as silk. And the client comes back and complains. Now, you don't want to get in a lawsuit with it, because if you have to hire me, it's going to be a lot more expensive. The client says, I'm going to pay you 90. I'm not going to pay you 100 grand. And you're like, crap, if I have to call Hanahan, it's going to cost me $10,000 at the end of the week. I am not going to call my lawyer. So instead of getting a fight with this guy, maybe I should get 100 grand, but it's only $10,000. And so I'll give you a discount. You're right. We were late on this, or there was this problem. Because nothing ever goes perfect. And you're not required to be perfect. The standard of care doesn't do perfect. But you think for good business purposes that it's worth it to pay the 90 and have a good review from this client and get more business from this client than it is to get into a dispute. So your books say you have generated $100,000 worth of business. The other staff of your books say you only received $90,000 of that $100,000. Your realization is 90%. So this model here is based on you get $100,000 for every single project, 100%, no matter what. Reality says is there's going to be projects where you're going to not get 100% the realization rate. You're only going to get 90% or 95% because there's going to be times where the client's disgruntled. There's going to be times where your younger architect spends 30 hours on a project that you know you could have done in 4. And you can't reasonably justify billing the client for those 30 hours, so you only bill 15 of them. So you only actually send out bills for 15, but you got to eat on your books 15 hours that your client, your architect, your revenue generating architect billed. I mean, that happens all the time. Like if I, when I get my bills from like for my clients, I have associates working on them, even for my time. Like there's some, like I worked on a project. This is Scott Honest Truth. I worked on something yesterday. I will not bill the client for it. I spent 3 hours working on it. I will not bill the client a dime for it. I will record my hours so the firm knows that I wasn't just screwing around. And when the bill comes across to my desk to send to the client, I will strike out those 4 hours, and they won't be charged for that. Because while it was necessary work and it was work being done, the value of the project, the value to the client, the value, there's all these things that factor in as business that you bring into it. So the firm sees that there's 4 hours that I never got revenue for, but that I billed for it. So my realization rate for that is so it's 4 hours. Let's say it's a 10-hour project, and I only billed 6 of the 4. So my realization of that would only be 60%. So that's what it means. It's how much you are collecting versus how much you actually billed. Does that make sense now? Question.
Do I assume some part of the calculation should be added?
Yeah, but I don't do any taxes. Like, I don't even do my own taxes, so I don't put any taxes in this analysis. There's so many other line items that would go onto these charts that I don't want to even remotely try to delve into, so there's lots of more stuff. This is at the very basic level. And for, like I said, there will be no math for these types of things. What I want you to understand is there are costs. And the costs are these. There are expenses, the concept of the expenses. So an expense is your professional liability. I want you to understand that that falls on one side of the chart. It's an expense. A cost is payroll. And there's a sheet that we're going to come up that's going to show you that. That's what I want you to understand for the test. But I'm working through this as a real project so you kind of understand it in context of a project in a business. So, but what I really, for the exam part of this, these are concepts, it's not math, it's not, I'm never going to ask you to say, here's a project, show me how you would bid and how you would come out. Like, I'm never going to do that for you guys, but I want you to understand this as a concept. And it'll help you, actually, because when you go out, after the first couple of years, you're going to have someone, I guarantee you, because it happens all the time, you're going to work for a while, and one of your bosses is going to say, put together a budget. And you'll be like, what? I don't know, and the budget will take this stuff. You're going to say, oh, well, how many hours is it going to be? And how much SDDD, CD, ND, or BD, and then construction management. You're going to put those things together. And maybe you'll go back to look at the sheet and look at the percentages or however you do it. But you will one day need to conceptually understand these type of things. So that, and that's why I want you up here. Okay. So now we're going to do, how do we sustain operations? How do we keep going? So we're working off of the same concept here. So we're using the same numbers that we just went through. Okay, so you got to stay in business for profit. You got to generate. Now we're talking about real numbers. This goes to this realization rate concept. So you have to generate, just to keep the lights on an annual basis, $1,095,000. That means you have to generate, you have to get paychecks, or you have to get invoice paid by your clients. This is for a small firm of only 8 architects and 2 other people. You have to have coming in the door $91,250 a month. Coming into the door every single month, $91,000 on an average, to be able just to keep the lights on. If you want to make a profit, so your profit is, I had my $1,095,000. I want to make a 20% profit here. So now I have to generate and get payments every year of a little over $1.3 million. Take that over 12 months. So you have to have $109,000 coming in every single month to be able to make this business, this small little business, profitable. So, and that's just the straight architecture side, because remember, you're paying your consultants the other $200,000. This was based on this whole, the percentage. It's actually more than a third of what your costs are. So, this costs, just to keep the lights on for your business, is almost $110,000 a month. You got to get paychecks, or you got to get payments in from your clients. Which starts to kind of question. How do you get clients? Oh my God, that's the age-old question. When you figure it out, send me a memo. How you get clients, and we actually have a lecture on that. I don't think it's today. I think it's maybe today. I can't remember but which one it is. There are different methods of different ways of getting clients, and it's like cold calling. You can do, you can be in different type of competitions. Your reputation, you work for people, you have you know people, you're a good person. There's so many different ways of clients. There's and some people are really good at it, and some people are really not good at it. Some people want to be really good at it, and they're not so good at it. That may be me. I do okay. There are just some people that are natural. There's a million different ways. I don't know how to answer that question. Like I said, when you figure it out, hopefully you'll figure it out and you'll be happy, and that's good. But that is the age-old question of keeping in business. So, okay. So remember this, at least revenue generation of $1.3 million and $109,000 or almost $110,000 a month is just for the architect side, because you've got to bring in more money on the other side to pay for your consultants. So we have, remember I said roughly one-third, so just to make it easy math, I did 65-35. So now you're bringing in $1.3 million to pay for your part of the deal, but you're still shelling out money to the consultants, your electrical engineer, your structural engineer, your mechanical engineer. On an annual basis, you're going to be paying those three consultants, because you have your 65% is $1.3 million. And then you add 35% when you do the math. I didn't put the math on here, but this math is right. The consultants, you're going to be paying them $707,000. So now to get that, you really have to generate $2 million in fees a year, because the owner is going to be paying you, and then some of that money, 35% of that money, you're paying to someone else. So $200,000 a year means that you need to get, where's my thing, blah, blah, blah. Oh, so it's not $110,000, it's not $109,500, it's not $110,000 you have to generate every month. You have to generate $168,000 every month. So if we go back a couple slides, if you think about it as we run the business here, the first one here, you're like, oh, I only need to generate $91,000 a month. No, you really have to generate $109,000 a month. No, what you're really generating is $168,000 a month, which is $38,000, almost $39,000 a week. It's almost $8,000 a day. You have to get money coming into your hand, $8,000 a day, for this small little architecture firm to survive and make a 20% profit. So when you start thinking about it, like, it's not the easiest thing, and I don't do this to scare you to say, oh my God, don't ever hang your shingle and everything else, but this is why, if you ever do hang your shingle, hire someone that can tell you how to do all this stuff. Not me. I'll help you with the contracts of your business, contracts to open up your business and make sure you register with the state and your license and all that other stuff, and I'll help you with your contracts. But hire a business professional to figure out, to your question of how do I get clients, do I have enough clients? When I want to go out on my own, do I have enough people that I've been doing design work for at my current firm that they like me, they've only worked with me, and when I go hang my shingle, they're going to come with me, plus I'm going to market and get new people, such that me and my extra couple, because I'm not going by myself, I'm the principal, I'm bringing a couple of my senior associates, I'm going to hire a couple of younger architects, we're going to start this business with 10 people, because I know a lot of people, I got 8 designers and I got 2 other people, we as a team are going to start this. Do we have enough to make sure that we can get $170,000 across our doorstep every single month? And then next year, you got to get more because everybody gets a raise. And then the next year, everybody gets a raise. So 168 becomes 175. 175 becomes 190. 190 becomes 220. on an annual basis. So, and I don't, like I said, I don't just freak out, but it is kind of sobering when you start to look at it. It's like, when you think about anybody that works, when you think about who's, like, have passion, compassion for the CFO, and the people that are in management that aren't on the boards drawing and everything else, because they're taking care of this stuff for you. Like, we all think about our paychecks coming in, we all look at the end of the year, we should get a bonus, we want to make sure we have our health insurance, and you have earned all of that. But recognize that behind the scenes of running a business, is there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. And so I give this to you as an overall concept, that these are parts of what it is when you want to run an architectural firm. Questions on this? Yes? Which one? This one.
So you're saying that for a firm to make $2 million something, they need to have $50 million
So, and I'm sorry that I skipped that, so I will say that again to make sure. Like, if I am a firm that always charges a percentage of cost of the work, and I did this as the simplest one because the percentage of cost of work to get to work the math backwards, is if I need to generate just over $2 million of revenue every year, and I'm charging an average of 4% of the cost of the work, that means the construction cost of the projects in total that were built is $50 million worth of projects. So if you're doing home residential home and you're in a small town America where like the highest house is maybe $600,000, $700,000, you're doing a lot of homes. Because it's not like they're not building $1 million homes. There's a lot of $200,000 and $300,000 homes if you're in a small town America. If you can land one big project, you may make it in one project. You know, you're like, oh, I got to design a mall. That mall costs $50 million to build. You may make it all in one project. And so there's all different ways, and that's what another thing that I don't get into any of these slides, when you start to look at how much the value of the buildings you've built, where you start to say, well, should I just be residential? Can I be a mixed-use architect or whatever? I mean, one of the things that I look at is, like, I go back and look at the dollar value of the buildings that, as a lawyer, that I've built, and I put those in quote marks because I don't build anything, but the contracts that I've drafted, and I'm well over $40 billion worth of construction. Because I've built a couple billion-dollar facilities. I've worked on many facilities that are $200 and $400 million. I've also worked on $10,000 projects. But there's huge volume. So it's a big number, the $50 million. But as an architect, you actually can, if you get a couple big projects, you can get there relatively easily. So it just kind of depends on how things go and what your model is and what you want to do. So.
In my mind,
that's not where you do the percentage, though.
No.
If you take 50 million times 4%, because you're getting 4% of the construction costs. So 4% of the construction costs, 4% of this gets you to the 2 million. So the way you do this is an inverse ratio, without getting into the whole math. So this would be if you take 2 million divided by 0.04, it gets to the 50 million.
Right.
So it's not 1.4. So.
It's
0.04. If you multiply 2, you're talking about 2 million times 1.04? If you multiply the 2 million by 1.04, you get just a little bit over 2 million. So it's a division project. We don't have to do math here. Remember, there's no math on the exam. It's just a division project. That's okay. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Question back there.
Yeah, so with the profit, where is that going? Is that going back to the business level, the owner,
or the profit as where it goes to is an excellent question. And the employees want the profit to all go to them, including the managers and the owners. But a good business manager says it has to go into the upgrading of the business. It has to go through, we got to buy a new plotter printer. We got to make sure that we keep up in technology, that goes into marketing. So there's lots of things that it can go into. But depending on how you do your pro forma, what you do is at the beginning of the year, when you set your budget for the year, you should say, and you go back to that very first slide, you say, here's all my salaries, here's all my costs, here's all my expenses. We need to have those things. And as long as we have enough line items, that even one line item may be R&D, one line item be as an allowance or an open expense for additional equipment or whatever those things are, as long as you have all of those, then the profit that comes in could be just pure profit broken down into salaries and bonuses paid to the employees. And so what will happen with that, and like in a partnership, what like the way that works at my firm, and we have 1,300 lawyers, I'm a partner, so I'm part of the profit. There's a profit pool, and there's actually two levels of profits, profit pools, and I'm not in the highest level, so they get more money than I do. So what they do is, and then bonuses for the associates, that's a line item in the expenses. So they already have that tucked into their budget. So what happens is they pay all the costs and all the expenses and all the bonuses for everybody that's not a partner. And then what's left over, they have this other pool. And then this pool gets divided up into two more pools. And I'm in the bottom of those two pools. And so I get my bonus out of that. And then depending on how those pools are broken down, it's how long you've been at the firm, how much you've generated that year versus last year. They look at it a five-year analysis. There's all these different ways of doing things. And that's just the way you set up your business. Different businesses set it up. But so yeah, the 20% profit, you would hope goes only to bonuses and stuff like that. But it depends how you set up your budget at the beginning of the year. So, do you have a question? You look like you have one. Okay.
The 4%? Yes.
The cost?
But does the percentage change according to the construction volume? So let's say we have a construction for 100 million. Can we charge more of a percentage or less?
So the percentage here is 4%. The question is if there's more volume of business, so there's more construction. So instead of $50 million worth of construction, it's $100 million of construction. Will the 4% go up? The answer to that question is what the contract is with the owner. So the owner, when you enter in a contract with the architect and the owner, not the construction cost or anything else, you say, I will design this project for you for 4% of the cost of the work. And so that will stay the same, unless there's these other kind of very, remember I said a 90 to 95% chance it never moves, it stays. There's this a couple of weird situations where maybe the project is too old, too long, and you get a bump for that or some other things. But that 4% is going to stay. And this analysis here is based on that for every single project, you did it on a percentage of the cost of the work, and every single project it was 4%. Some projects you're going to charge 8%. Some projects you're going to charge 2%. This is just as a random or an average that you average out 4% of the cost of the work. That's what you charge. So that number, that 4%, will not change because it's already been set up into a contract. What's going to happen is if this is $100 million in business, that 4%, that's going to be $4 million. So your revenue will be, you'll generate more revenue because you have more buildings built, but the percentage you're charging to design fee stays the same.
Every time?
Well, it depends. No, not for every owner, every client. You negotiate with that client at the beginning, your contract. So like when you enter as an owner, as an architect into a contract with an owner, you're going to say, I will design this building for you for 4%. And you sign that contract. The next one you say, it's a little more complex, I will design that building for 6%. And that one's 6%. And the next one you say, well, this is really weird. I'm going to design it for 10% because it's a renovation thing. So now you have three different contracts that are different percentages. And if you add those all together, your average is going to be like 7%. So that would be a 7% average. But this is just based on a 4% average for all your projects. Okay? Okay, so now we're looking at production costs. So now we got to make sure, how do we get that $68.44 an hour if you're actually going to be designing on it? Like when you're actually, now you're looking at how many hours does it take to do this project? What am I going to do? How do I get these costs? So we assume we have a project that is a $12 million construction cost. Okay, so we're going to build this building and it's $12 million. It's a little strip mall. We're going to build a $12 million strip mall. And you design fee based on 4% of the cost of work. Owner comes to you and says, I want to build a strip mall. My budget is $12 million. How much are you going to charge me? I'll do it at the cost of the work at 4%. That's what I'll do my percentage is. How do you budget the total amount of hours that may be spent to design and still remain profitable? How do you figure that out? Okay? So, if it's a $12 million project, at 4% of the cost of the work, that means you're going to generate $480,000 of revenue by billing the client. Okay? Follow that? Now, you've got a structural engineer, you've got a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, you're going to have to pay them. And that 35.5% is broken down into the 12.5%, 22% here to get to your three different things. So you have to take from the 480 that you're totally generating revenue for from the $12 million project, you have to subtract because you've got to pay those three engineers $165,000. Now you have what's called a spec writer. A spec writer is the guy that does your specification book and sort of the detailed part. And so you'll learn about spec writers. So I just put a plug number in here for $5,000. And then you have a coordination of the engineer. Somebody's got to coordinate all the drawings together, so there's a cost for that. So it's another $16,000. So you take your $480, you subtract all these things. Oh, and by the way, you want to make a profit. So 20% of your $480,000 is $96,000. So right here, you have this. You have to take out your profit margin because I want to be profitable in every project, right? So this says here that then you need to generate and you need to be able to make sure you can do the project for $198,000 of actual cost internally. Actual cost internally. Now remember, the very, very first slide we had, which is just the revenue generators. Remember, there's the revenue generators and then there's the expenses, okay? So your revenue generators, this number, the $68.44, is your cost, not what you bill them, because when you bill them, you have to build in all the other stuff to get to your profit level. To get to that $85 an hour, you've built in a bunch more stuff. But this is your internal cost, okay? So for $198,000, and you have $68, you need to be able to design this entire project, that first chart, SD, DD, CD, BD and construction thing, that chart that we had, has to be within 2,893 hours. Those are actual working hours. How many people you have on the project and everything else. You say, okay, I've got this $12 million project. I've got to make sure my revenue generators, my eight architects, whoever's working on it, work no more than 2,893 hours. And if we work more than 2,893 hours, I am losing money. And it's going to dip into my profit margin, my $96,000. Does that make sense? So how do we figure that out? We bring back the chart. SD, DD, CD, DM, and construction costs. For the SD, you have one person working on it. And they work 8 weeks, because it's a longer project than the first chart that I had up. They're going to be 8 weeks working on FD at 40 hours a week, and they're doing that's 320 design hours. And then you have BD, you got two people, because you got to have more people, and more. It's getting a little more media, takes more time, and they're working 8 weeks at 40 hours, so now you have 640 hours. CD, you bring on another person on the team because you got to be working, and that's going to be for 16 weeks at $40 an hour. And you have 1,920 hours, which is roughly, you're going to say, 120 hours average a week for 16 weeks. Is this actually enough? You're going to even say, is this enough to do all the CDs? Because CDs take so much work. Is that the right percentage breakdown? One person for doing bidding negotiation, and then we have 3/4 of a person for construction management because they're not working on it all the time. They're working on it a partial time. They have a couple of different projects and everything else. Now, all of a sudden, you realize to design this project is 4,600 actual hours of people working in your team. But your budget only allowed for 2,893. That means you have a deficit. You are 1,700 hours over budget. That's $116,000 loss to this project when you were only going to generate $480,000. That's pretty bad. So this is why when I talk about when you're doing lump sum and when you're looking at it, when you start to figure out how much time, you've got to be out there for a while, because if you start doing a calculation and you said, oh, 4%, that sounds like what the market is, I know I can do it, and then it turns out instead of 2,800 hours to do it, it takes you 4,600 hours to do it, you're not going to stay in business very long. So what do? You run this calculation internally. You don't go to the client. What you do is you say, the market's going to bear 4, 5, 6%. I want to be under the market, so I'm going to go really aggressive. I'm going to bid at 4% for a cost for this project. And then you run the numbers and you're like, I can't do it for 4%. It's not going to work. So you go back and you rerun the numbers. So that's what this next slide does. Next slide says we're going to go up to 6.75%. We're going to jump, because you haven't shown, by the way, you don't show the client 4%. You've done that behind the scenes. So now you're saying, does the market bear 6.75%? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but that's what you have to do. And so you recalculate all this. And so you take your 6.75, and these numbers, for the same reason, change. This goes from the 480 to 810. And these go from the 60, I think this is 105, these numbers here go up, because what you have to pay your engineer is still based on a percentage. Now, you may be able to get a cheaper engineer that works, and you can make some profit, you can maybe work some stuff in there, but these numbers are going to go up. When your fees go up, so do their fees go up. It's just the way you do this analysis. SpecWriter, I kept the SpecWriter the same, but everything else is going to go up. So now, but your profit goes up too. Remember, this was $96,000. Now your profit here is $162,000, because your original cost is 20% of $810, $162,000. So this goes up, which is good for you. So now what you do is you have to be able to design this project for $326,000 instead of $198,000 that we had in the first analysis. So if we go to the next slide, we take that $198,000 and we do the same math. These don't change because it's the same project. It's still one person at 8 weeks, two people at 8 weeks, three people at 16, and so forth. These stay the same. This becomes static. And you still get the 4,600 hours to build this project. But you budgeted 4,700 hours. When you did the math, you were able to budget. If you took that, if you go back one slide, hold on. If you take that I should probably have one more line here. If you take that 326,132 and you multiply that times the 6844, so I should probably have one more line here. That gives you a budgeted hours of 4,675 hours. So now, in this case, you are actually under budget. You allowed yourself in your analysis 4,765. You came in 4,600. So now you got 165 excess, which equals another 11,000. So you had your profit of 162, and you got a little more profit here. Ends up getting that you get $173,000 in profit. So this is a profitable job, even with your profit margin in. But back to your original question, is that 20% all going into the workers' pockets, or have you already allocated some of that profit to what's called overhead, and so you may not be able to have as much to play with, and so this additional $11,000 is nice, because that, you could say, is pure profit. It goes definitely off your books into the workers' pockets. So this is a way, so you have to go back. Now, you can maybe say, all right, maybe I don't want to skin it too tight, maybe the market won't bear out 6.75%, so maybe I go back to 6%. And maybe with 6%, you don't get any of this in the green, but you're close to, knowing that you have some wiggle room in your 20% profit. So there's different ways to do this of how you calculate. And again, all of this is assuming that the owner pays you 100 cents on the dollar. You have 100% realization rate. Question?
Because of the
question
already on top of the profit, yes. You can play around a little bit more with trying to, obviously you'd love to get as much cushion as you can, but you very more flexibility to kind of dial things in here.
Yeah. Yes, and that's exactly what you end up doing. You should go in and you bid, maybe depending on if it's an RFP where you're bidding to get the job. And maybe you say, I could get this a little extra wiggle if I bid the job at 6.75, but if I come in at 6.5 or 6.25, I know I'm more competitive. and I know I'm still within, because I had that 20% profit margin already built into my analysis. You always want to build in, when you are pricing out any project, you must include your profit in your pricing of the project. If you don't put it in there, you will never get it. So you always put in, when you start looking at your actual design hours and people working and all your other costs and all your other expenses, you have to put in a line item that says, like here, profit. It's below the line, but you have to put that in to make sure you make a profit. And everybody does that, and everybody knows that. Now, you're not going to show, to your question earlier, you're not going to show the owner this calculation where it shows what your profit margin is. You're going to build those into the numbers that fall on this sheet. You're going to say hours, 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 percentage of how much revenue generated. And that was that very first chart of the cash burn rate in that very far right column. So that's how you do it. And so to your question, yes, if you have built in from the previous slide the 20% profit, and you come to here and say, now it looks like I'm going to be making like 22% profit, maybe my business can operate at 15% profit, so I can come in and bid this project instead of 6.75% cost of work. I can bid it at 6.25% cost of the work. And if we're really efficient, it falls in the middle. But if things go right, or if things do even go a little bit wrong, I'm still making a profit. So this gives you the flexibility. So, question over here. Yes. Well, the estimate, which estimate, I guess, is my question to you?
No.
This is what happens. What happens here is, if we go back to, well, it's many slides back, but I'll go back to it so you can see it. No. Good question. Okay, so there's two questions. Is all these numbers, are they being put into the estimate that the architect contractually does at the end of each phase to give an estimate of what the value of the project is? And then the second question is, to prepare all these estimates, isn't there a cost in doing that, and is this factually? So those are two questions. So the answer to the first question is no, that has nothing to do, your cost analysis that we've been doing these last half a dozen slides has zero to do with your estimating of the project going forward. It's when the owner comes to you and says, I have a budget of $12 million, and you take their budget and you say, how do I make a profit off of that budget? I know the cost that they can spend is $12 million, and I'm going to be charging them a percentage of the cost of the work. What percentage of the cost of work do I have to charge them, knowing, because I've done strip malls. They came to me because I'm a strip mall guy. So I've done a bunch of them, and I know how many people design hours I have to put into it. And so I know it's going to be 4,600 design hours. What do I have to charge as a percentage of the cost of the work of that $12 million to make sure that I get the number of design hours? This sheet here, if I charge 4% of the cost of the work, means I lose money. This sheet here, if I charge 6.75% of the cost of the work, not only do I gain money in my profit, but I get a little bit more money. All of those and all these calculations are done before you even have signed a contract. You are doing this as part of your job to pay for the business, to get the business. And so I'll give you an example. So some of the projects that I've worked on, some of the larger projects that are in the hundreds of millions of dollars, you go out for what's called an RFP, a request for proposal. And so on a $500 million project, the contractor, this is on the contractor side or whatever, but it's a huge project that they want to get. They will put together a very robust packages, pages upon pages, and videos, and all these other things to show this is what we're going to build for you. Architects will do the same thing when they want to design a project. They will say, here's our team, and here's what we've done in the past, and here's our costs, and here's this, and flowing, and here's some... Architects will even provide preliminary schematic designs of what the project may look like. So the owner can be like, oh, that's really cool. Like, all of that are costs that the owners, the architect, and the contractor will not recover as a direct cost. Some of the RFPs that I've seen for these large projects will cost the contractor between $500,000 and $1 million. I mean, it's not like they're going to spend a weekend and slap something together. Some of these things are so elaborate, and they'll fly in teams from all over the country and do a presentation, and it takes 6-8 weeks, and there's lots of stuff that goes into it. So I have seen $500,000, $750,000 proposals, and how do they get that money back? There's going to be a line item in here that's going to have another line item above the line that'll say proposal. You're never going to show the owner. You're going to put that in there, and you're going to bury it into your cost of running your business. Or it'll even go back in that very, very first sheet when we had the left-hand column with the revenue generators and the right-hand side with the expenses with the secretary and the insurance and all that other stuff. It may be a line item for an annual cost for business development. And it could be like a huge number. Business development, marketing, and so it all falls into that. So you get the money back, but it's not going to be seen directly by the owner. And that's why this is at a 30,000, even a 50,000 foot level of my analysis. There's many more line items. Marketing and business development will fall into that. Then once you get into the project and you start doing your actual estimates, that's going to be a cost for the owner to be performing work. So in this 8 weeks to 40 hours, maybe the last week, all they're doing is an estimating. So you build your estimating because your estimating is something contractually required to provide it. That's in this 40 hours. At the end of this phase, that's in this 40-hour week, and that's in this. So the estimate work that you must do, that's the second half of your question, you build that into this model. So that's real numbers. The first number to get the job is not recoverable as a black and white. You will eventually build it into your hourly rate, but this is to build, you'll build it into your actual hours of the job. You know that an estimate is going to take 20 hours of your time, and so you build in 20 hours into this schedule, or whatever it is. Does that help? Okay. So, here, I think this is the last one. So you, Yeah. So we'll try increasing to 6.75. That gets you, so you definitely made it here. So cushion 165 hours. So your cushion here, that's about $11,000, translates to about 165 extra hours of work. Remember, it was 4,600 versus 4,765. So you have a flexibility of, like, if I have to write time off, if my architects aren't as efficient, maybe I have to redesign stuff because I screwed up. So you have this cushion here of 165 hours, but maybe that cushion might not be enough. So even though on black and white it shows you're going to get an extra $11,000, you may not get that because you may have to eat those costs. As I told you yesterday, I had 4 hours of work for a client. I'm not billing them any. That would come out of that 165 extra hours. That cushion that's built into everything sometimes gets eroded away. That's just the cost of doing business. So, again, the next bullet here, the client wants a bargain. I'm not paying you 100 grand, I'm paying you 90. You have to balance between good business, standing your guns, hiring a lawyer. Where does that fall into it? I will tell you this. I have many times, I can't even count the amount of times I've had a homeowner call me and tell me there's something wrong with their brand new house. And I ask them what's wrong with their house, and they tell me what it is. And it's tragic, and some of it's really sad, like there's a leak here, this or that. And I'm like, what was the value of your house that you'd pay for it? I paid $600,000 for the house. I'm like, I know that really sucks and everything else. It's going to cost you more money to hire me and to litigate this than to go hire a good contractor and fix it. There's been so many times where I've, and it's mostly in the residential market because it's very personal and everything else, where I said, here's a good contractor, call him. Here's somebody else and call them. Fix your house. After you fix the house and you look how much you cost, and if you're still really angry, call me back and I'll sue them. But get the things fixed, because a lot of times it's not worth the money. And so when you get a client here that says, I don't want to pay you for your design fees, 100%, I want to pay you 100 cents on the dollar. Be business-wise. Recognize that sometimes negotiations is much better than filling up your life with being with lawyers. Like, I want the business, of course, but litigation sucks. It's really hard on people, so... Just be reasonable about it as an architect and make sure. Last thing you want to do is spend time in court, because if you're in court or you're at a deposition or you're talking to your lawyer, you're not making money because you're not on the boards. You're not designing. So, or whatever they call it now. In my days, they call it being on the boards. You're not on the computer, whatever it is. Sometimes you have to give discounts, cut rates, sometimes because it's a big client. Maybe it's a big client, low client. There's some ways. So maybe even move up to 7.5, 7.75, whatever it is. These are things you're going to have to look at is what the market bears out. This is what's going to look at is what your profitability is. Who's on your team? You know, you're going to have your A team working on it. Is it going to be the senior architect and the principal as opposed to the two junior architects? All those things are going to factor into whether you can make a profit and how it goes. And that's every single project. So you can generate that, remember, $168,000 a month in the door every month until next year when it's $172,000, and the following year it's $185,000, and so forth. So, okay. A few more slides and we're done. Marketing fees. This goes back to your question. How do we get business? I couldn't remember if it was this one or not. Why would a client select you as an architect? Why would you get hired? Well, they know you. Like the person that did our backyard 100 square foot thing that I talked about, where we just flipped the porch into a little mudroom. We knew the lady. We knew the architect. She was a friend of ours, so we knew her. Or they know your work. They've seen you out there, like they saw a sign on a project or whatever. Somebody said, hey, I know this person that did this. Or call this other person. Lots of other things. Or you're recommended. Those are ways. That's the first simplest way. The best and simplest way to get jobs is people know who you are. It's close, it's intimate, and recommendations. There's a feeling, there's comfort. It comes in as a better relationship as opposed to an unknown. That's the first way. How do they get to know you? How do you get out there? So one thing here is widen your circle of acquaintances. Join an organization. And it doesn't have to be an architectural organization. You know, find an interest. Play pickleball. Or whatever it is at the time. Something like that. Like, I'm on a hockey team. I'm on a hockey team because I like to play hockey and everything else, but I have people from there, and you can occasionally sometimes get a business recommendation. So it's just kind of get to know the people. Or maybe you write articles or journals or something. Maybe you get out there and you publish. One of the things that I do, as you guys know, I have these lectures, and I put them on my website. I am at my firm of 1,300 lawyers. More people go to my bio page than any other person in the firm. Because people like you and people out there that are taking the ARE's listen to these lectures, which I think is wonderful. I don't charge them for anything. They're all free. They can do what they want. Sometimes I get a postcard and somebody says, hey, thank you for helping me get through the exam. I'm like, that's wonderful to them. Have I gotten business out of it? A little, not a lot, but I've gotten some business but that's the way people get to know me. And the couple of projects that I've gotten actually have been pretty substantial, the ones that I've gotten. So that's just the way that you get out there. Know your work. So how do they know your work? Well, in the beginning, maybe you just take every job you get. When you first hang that shingle, you're like, yeah, I can do it. You take everything you can. Starting a business is never easy, so you gotta pay the bills. You gotta get that $168,000 a month coming in. As I said, I think on Wednesday, I talked about maybe competitions. Maybe you're out there, you're published. It doesn't get built, but they see you and they can go in. Maybe get yourself in a magazine and professional, where you can teach. I love teaching here because I love teaching. I don't teach this to generate business at all. I just love doing this. But there's ways you can get out. Speaking circuits, there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I will tell you this. There are more publications and speaking opportunities than people to fill them. You will always be able to write or to speak. When you guys get out there, there will be hundreds of places and opportunities for you guys if you just want to get up there and talk about what you did. And that's and it'll start right when you get out. I mean, I get calls all the time, and it's not just because I've been doing this 30 years. I've been getting this for 30 years. People calling, hey, will you speak with us? Will you do this and that? It's easy to get yourself out there, surprisingly. You have to put yourself out there, and you got to get used to talking in front of people. But there's lots of ways to get your name out there. And then there's, you know, LinkedIn and all the other stuff that you can publish and stuff. So, and that's where I have the publication, presentations, and so forth. So there's all different ways to get people to know your work. They may never not know you personally. They may not have recommended you. They're like, oh. And the people that I've gotten business from are the people that are like, hey, I listened to your lecture. I don't really know you, but do you do this? And then we talk about it. And then I say, yeah. And then we're like, do stuff. So they don't know who I am. They don't know anything. They just have heard me on this microphone for whatever they did. So, okay. Now, the other question is, there's this difference between the concept of marketing and selling. So marketing is how you get your name out there. Okay? Cold calls, networking, conventions, all the things on the previous page is how you get yourself out there when you market. The selling part of it is when you make that presentation, when you actually have a potential client, and you say, I can do this for 6.5% of the construction cost, and here's what it's going to look like. So the selling part is much more personal. And that's when you're going to have to your question is, how do you get businesses? Who are the people that you want to present and they'll like and they'll trust? And there are going to be brilliant people that work at a company that you're at that are terrible at selling because that's just not what they do. And there are going to be people that are average at what they do, but they are really good at personal and people. And so that's what you have to figure out. How do you present? And sometimes you're going to have that brilliant person make that presentation. They're going to put together this brilliant design and PowerPoint or whatever it is. And so there's all different ways that you can look to your team and who fits into what slots. Who goes on the pitch? Who prepares the pitch? How do those all things together? So that's part of the selling. Now, interestingly enough, because when you're selling, you are actually marketing as well, because they may say, well, you're not good for this one, but maybe for the next one. So you are broadcasting yourself. But the selling part becomes much more personal, I believe, at least the way you close that deal. And the last thing here is, now you get the client. What do you charge the fee, and how do you get to sign the agreement? And so I think that's part of what we did for that analysis. What's the fee? So you go through that whole part of what the percentage is and the cost of the work, where are your dollar figures. So it's kind of, this slide here ends with you got the client, but it goes back to the very beginning of today's lecture. Now you start working these charts through to figure out how much you charge the fee, and they get them to sign the agreement as part of, you make them comfortable, you've hired your lawyer, you get the terms right, and then they sign the agreement. So, last slide here, I believe, or two more slides here. It's what our issues are there. The terms of the deal, this is like the fee and everything else. What's included, what's not included in your fee. Make sure you communicate with your client and make sure the contract spells it out. It's a lump sum project, but if I have to do extra work, I'm being paid for hourly, and here are my hourly rates. It's the cost of the work, and if I have to do extra, that's the cost of the work. There's all different ways you can mix and match, so you want to make sure you communicate to them. When is the fee paid? That's a question. Well, it's not after the construction starts. Here's my chart that shows that you're going to have a burn rate of X dollars per month. That's something that you can always go back to that chart and say, this is what you should expect, owner, of what the fees are going to be. How do you charge for reimbursable expenses? I've got to go in a taxi cab. I got to get food because I'm working late. Whatever those costs are. And reimbursable expenses also includes when you hire a consultant. I hire a structural engineer, an electrical engineer, because I have to pay them. And until you pay me, I have to carry those costs. So what do you do with that? Well, you mark it up. You say, if I have to pay for a dinner, or if I have to pay for my cab fare to the project site, or whatever they'll have to fly to a project site, I will pay those out of my own pocket, and I will charge you that cost plus 10%. Because it's sitting on my credit card anyway, charging me probably at 13% or whatever it is. So you are able to charge a percentage increase. Now, some owners may try to negotiate that down, but that's where you have to figure out where that works in your profit margin. So it's a line item of actual carrying costs that would be another one on your pro forma. But you can have, and you'll see in Article 11 of B101, they'll say, there's literally a sentence that says reimbursable expenses plus, and it has a blank and a percentage. So the contract, the B101, is designed for you to fill in a number there, 5%, 10%, 15%. 10 to 15 is pretty average in the industry. How do you define the scope of the work? You got to make sure when the client comes to you and says, I got $12 million for a strip mall, you say, okay, got it. What's in the strip mall? How many stores? What are the size and the square footage of stores? How much is the parking lot structure going to be? Is there going to be a parking lot? Is there going to be a structure or not a structure? You want to make sure you have a full understanding of what that scope of work is, and then you'll distill it down into a paragraph or two that goes into the contract. That'll go on the very first page. And that'll go into the initial information sheets, if you remember in Article 1, describing what the project is. So when it's later and you do your first estimate, you haven't gone way over the budget or way under the budget because you didn't understand what the project is. So that's what's going to go into the contract part of the deal. Special cases, these are three bullets here. These are in Article 4 of the B101, 4.2.3, I think. How many times do you visit the site? Once a week, twice a month, when needed? How many times are you reviewing shop drawings? Once, and if I have to do it twice, I get paid for the second time. A lot of times this is, normally the industry is probably two. I'll review two sets of, a shop drawing, if it's not approved, I send it back, fix it architect, or plumber, or mechanical contractor, whatever, they send it back. After the second time, if it's not approved, you get paid on an hourly rate for the third, fourth, and fifth. Same thing if you have to do drawings for different phases and reuse and copyright licenses. All those things you want to build into your contract, and they're all built into, there's different sections in the B101 to allow you to have a dollar figure for all those. Here, this last one, what's the form of the agreement? Again, I would recommend always having a written contract. You'll get a written contract in the last lecture of the class here that you can take. It's actually like the B101, only it's more tailored to, even more tailored to you than the B101 is. But the B101 is the gold standard out there, so you can, no matter what project you're in, if you want to just pull out the B101, you're not going to go wrong. It's got everything in it. And tell the client that. Last of the things you got to resolve when you're doing it is you got to hire outside consultants. So we talked about that, mechanical engineer, structural engineer, electrical engineer. So you need to explain to the owner, I work with this team, these are the people that I'm going to bring in with. I've worked with them for so long, I'm very trusting, here's where their rates and fees are going to come in. So, and you should work to get a stable of good structural, mechanical, electrical engineers to work with on over and over basis. You'll have your go-tos that will work on companies. Sometimes if you work in the office building world, sometimes you'll go in and they will have their list of mechanical, electrical, and structural engineers that they will allow you to use. So sometimes they have the buildings themselves say, we only use this team. But it helps you to have your own team to go in. What's all of their service? How many visits are they going to make? What's their rate of pay? You want to make sure that if they're charging you a 10% markup, that carries across to the owner so you don't lose money on that. You want to make sure that everything's a flow through so you're not losing money paying your subconsultants more than the owner's reimbursing you for that. Same contract conditions. If you owe A, B, and C to the owner as a designer, the subconsultants, the electrical engineer, mechanical engineer, structural engineer, also must owe you A, B, and C because you're responsible for everything downstream. So your contract with the owner must have mirror images with your contract with your subconsultant down below. They have to look the same or you'll get stuck in the middle. Make sure they have insurance. Again, make sure that they have a construction their own contract with you in writing. So, any questions on this more? Way back there.
I guess I'm kind of wondering, you might not know the answer, but why is it that people working on the sector are going to be underpaid? Is it because it's so competitive to get clients that people are going to lower their percentages?
So that's a great question, and I apologize to all of you that I haven't raised this before because it's something I talk about, and I'll talk about it a lot more the rest of the semester because it lends itself to that with some of the other lectures we're going to do. The first answer that I think is the most logical and reasonable is that the architects don't carry nearly the risk that the contractor does. So you design, but your design doesn't have to be perfect. Contractor is guaranteeing that the work they're doing is correct. The value of your services in comparison to the actual construction cost, if you look at it, 4, 5, 10%, so you are not carrying nearly the risk. If the owner's got a $12 million project, and of that $12 million, they're only going to be paying you $400,000, $500,000, then why should you be paid on a higher percentage? Because you're not carrying the risk, but the contractor carries the risk because they have the bulk of the problems that the cost could come. That's at the very highest level, the basic level. The contractors carry more risk. And that's one of the reasons why, if you go back about 30 to 40 years, design-build became a better model for the architect because the architect said, I'm not getting paid much. And the contractors were like, because you're not carrying any risk. And so the architect said, well, how about if we join together and I design and you build and we do it at the same time and we're a team and we share the profits And oh, by the way, the project gets done more quickly because it's not design, bid, build, it's design, and you'll see in some of the slides of alternate building methods, the construction starting while you're still designing, but you're carrying more risk. And then there's what's called architect-led design bid build, where the design build, where the architect is actually the principal and they hire the contractor. So there are methods to get the architects to get more money, but the very basic is they're not carrying enough risk. The second part of your question, though, is there a higher competition level? I don't know if it's higher competition level. I always think that architects underprice themselves. I think that, I will tell you this, when I got out, if you think it's bad now, when I got out, the architects were so poorly paid. It was just terrible. And like, I made a, like, people gave me grief. I told my architecture classmates when I started at school, I said, very first 2 weeks, I said, I'm going to law school. They're like, why are you even here? It's a 5-year program. Why are you even doing this? Like, because I love architecture, because I love design, and I'm going to go to Rome, and we're going to do this, and I love this, because I still love architecture. That's why I teach this class here. But I go, but I think architects need lawyers, and somebody told me when I was 13 that they do, and I want to do this because it sounds interesting. And I said, I remember saying this to one of my buddies who was like, he ended up being the most capitalistic of all of us, and he's very successful now. And I remember I looked at him, and I said, I'm going to bet you $20. This is my freshman year. I said, I'm going to bet you $20 that I'm going to make, when I walk out of law school, I'm going to make 3 times the money that you're making after 3 years of working in the industry. He paid me $20. Now, I didn't do it because I made more money, but architects notoriously don't pay themselves enough. Now, what I have seen, honest to God, what I have seen over the last probably 10 years, maybe a little bit longer, is that the good architects are now finally charging really good rates. Like, it's not uncommon to see a principal architect charging $500-$600 an hour. And that's something that they get more of a revenue and they can generate more money. But it's still very competitive. I mean, like I said, when you get into the interior office building and those percentages is 3-4% of the cost of the work, I mean, those are razor-thin margins that the architects get paid. You just have to be really good at it. But I think the first is the risk carrying. And then the second is I think they undermarket themselves, they undervalue themselves. So. Which is really frustrating, and this is why I said I can't believe I don't talk about it, because the skill that you guys, and the time that we spend in school, and the skill that you have, and what you have to do, like, architecture's not easy. Architecture's a hard profession, and you should get paid for it, because if you compare yourself to, like, doctors and lawyers and accountants, architects are not paid at that level, and they should be. That's my soapbox on that, but I'm a lawyer, so what do I do? Anyway, anything else? Does that help? Make sure you guys remember how much you're valued. Like, when you get out there, like, tell people you're valued at that. Like, I'm worth this. And maybe the market, I mean, like, I have seen the market change. I have seen a change where architects are getting paid what I would consider more of their worth and their value. I really have. So. All right. I will see you guys next week. You're welcome. Oh, and anybody...